Welcome to Coffee and Divination, a podcast about the arts of obtaining hidden knowledge in changing times. Join me, Joanna Farrar, to chat with experts from around the world on tarot, runes, geomancy, and the many ways divination can help us navigate and plan our paths ahead.
So thank you, first of all, for joining us today, and I am very happy to welcome back our guest, Peter Mark Adams. Peter has been on the show a couple of times before, so some of you are familiar with his work, but if you are not, Peter is an author and poet and essayist who specializes in the ethnography of ritual, sacred landscape, esotericism, consciousness, and of course, healing. He has over 20 years of experience with energy-based healing modalities, including rebirthing, breathwork, meridian therapies, and Reiki. He is a professional author. He has been published multiple times by Scarlet Imprint and Inner Traditions. Some of his more recent works include Mystai, Dancing Out the Mysteries of Dionysus, which he also came on the show to speak about not too long ago. And most recently, The Power of the Healing Field, Energy Medicine, Psi Abilities, and Ancestral Healing, which was recently published and which he is here. And I'm delighted to talk to him about it today. It's a book that I very much enjoyed and have already shared information about with my coven and with friends of mine, and I highly recommend it. So we are going to talk about it today, and I highly recommend that you check it out. So thank you for being here with us, Peter.
Oh, it's always a pleasure, Joanna.
Well, very much the pleasure is mine. So I wanted to, I've mentioned that, of course, it is about healing modalities, and you are you are a healer. That is something that you have, you know, decades of experience with outside of all of your other expertise. And I just wanted to, if you could just tell us a little of the story of the book and how it came about. I know that this is a, there was an earlier incarnation of this book, and then you were asked to sort of rework this book. Can you just tell us a little bit about how that happened?
Yeah, I mean, my own exposure to the energy field and working with energies actually occurred in my teens when I started practicing martial arts and doing Tai Chi. And that really gave me a entry into the field of energy medicine because, of course, it's the other side of the coin to the martial arts. Around, I don't know, 1998, I started practicing Reiki, Usui Reiki. And from there, I was led into, along with my partner, into a whole range of other healing modalities, which included family constellation therapy, cranial sacral therapy, so many different modalities. And from those, we have developed a practice based initially on Gary Craig's emotional freedom techniques and breathwork, rebirthing breathwork, and Reiki. Okay, so at that point, this would be around 2014, we had had so many extraordinary cases of healing and exposure to healing energies. Okay, when we're talking about Reiki, of course, we're talking about spiritually directed energy. So I initially wrote a text which I wanted to capture some of that amazement that we felt at the world of energy healing. And that was just self-published. It was a kind of local effort, but it ended up in the hands of Inner Traditions years later, and they loved it. So I took it back and reworked it from beginning to end, updated the methodology, updated the cases. And of course, we had a far better perspective on the entire field of energy healing by that time. And the result is The Power of the Healing Field, which is out there.
Yeah, and for people who haven't seen the book already, it's really wonderful the breadth of the topics that you are able to cover, which I think speaks to the fact that this is not, it's not a how-to guide. It's not a thing that goes into any one of those practices and says, here's how you would begin and, you know, beginning, middle, and end of it. But it gives that overview of what all of these things look like and why they all fit together, what the larger picture is of why this exists. And all of that kind of comes back to the idea of the field. Yeah. And so I think that is something that we should kind of address at the very start, because It is what all these other things draw on. So could you, for people who may not be familiar, what would be your definition of the field, or what you mean when you say that?
Okay, I think the base idea here is something called panpsychism. And it's the notion that consciousness is interwoven with reality on every level. And that it is just as we talk about the time-space continuum, we should actually be addressing the time-space consciousness continuum. So that's one big step for a lot of people to take, this notion that consciousness is not something generated by your brain. Okay, it's a field in which we're all immersed and all connected. And the role of the brain in this model is as a receiver transmitter. Okay, it's the interface to the field of consciousness. But the field of consciousness is a fundamental part of the universe. This is how the universe is structured. And if we take that one step further forward, we end up in animism. That's to say, the notion that personhood itself is distributed throughout the field, and that everything that partakes of the field of consciousness reaches a certain level of organization at which we can attribute personhood to it. And again, this is a really radical notion when you apply it to our day-to-day lives, because it implies a lot of change in terms of our behavior, in terms of our interactions with the world, and interactions with everything that exists within reality, and especially on an ethical level. So this is the kind of the field concept that I have. I'd like to add one thing more at this stage, but perhaps it's best if I illustrate it. I mean, one of the experiences that really helped me get this, because with my academic philosophical training, this was a real tall order to begin accepting a model of consciousness as distributed throughout reality. But I went along to family constellation therapy. And briefly, if you don't know what that is, you'll find a group of people in a room with a therapist, and two or three people probably want to undertake therapy. Okay. The rest of the people are there as participant observers. And what I mean by that is a person wanting therapy will select from that group, and these are absolute strangers generally, somebody to represent one or other of their family members. Okay, so it's a kind of random selection. They pick somebody and say, will you be my represent my father, mother, brother, sister, grandfather, even people who've long passed away can be represented. And they're then positioned in the middle of the room by this person in a way that seems intuitively correct to them in terms of the relationships. And something very extraordinary happens when you do this. If you are one of those people so chosen, you will suddenly feel yourself having an overlay of a set of thoughts and feelings which are not your own. Okay, so you have perfect access to your own thoughts, feelings, your own everything, but you have this overlay that you can now access. And this means that the simple fact of arranging people in a symbolic representation of a family unit or a systemic unit means that you can then access the larger field of consciousness through that generated field. So this is a second use of the notion of the field now. So we have the background field of consciousness, and we now have created a field through a ritual enactment of a particular system. And I say in family constellation therapy, that's normally a family unit. Even though some of the members may be long dead, it doesn't matter. So we've now generated a field within the field, so to speak, which gives us access to information that we couldn't normally have access to. And the strange thing about conflicts within families, they often have a profound ethical dimension to them. So that the therapist can then go through this group of people in the middle of the room, query them on whether they're feeling good or bad, and isolate the traumas and the injustices within that extended family lineage. And having done so through a process of acknowledgement and forgiveness, you can recode the field. And this is the important thing. This means that the field of consciousness has an ethical dimension to it, which is extraordinary. And when you recode it, you heal the traumas and the abuse and the injustice that has occurred in the past. Okay. So the reason I'm telling this story is that it illustrates better than any philosophical monologue from my side how the field actually operates in real terms.
Absolutely. It's fantastic. And it's also, I think what's beautiful about that is that it touches on so many different things that you, of course, speak to in the book, which is about the personal nature of healing, but also the much larger context of healing, like how that dips into past lives and ancestral work and things that are, you know, possibly much larger than the individual. Absolutely. And you talk early on in the book about the porosity, like the fact that in order to interact in many of these healing modalities, one of the first steps is being able to accept wider models of what personhood really means, and how that diversity and that enlarging of personhood to be much bigger than the kind of mechanical, I have a neat body that I inhabit and it has these things, and I will go to a mechanic who will fix these meat problems I am having. We have to first kind of acknowledge that we are much bigger than that. We are larger back into the past and possibly into the future as well. So is there anything that am I kind of missing on that? Because I feel like that already starts to get into that.
I think what I want to say about this notion of personhood is that we're normally told that outside present moment awareness, we have a biographical memory, and beyond that, a biographical unconscious. And that is pretty well it as far as the standard model of consciousness goes. What we find in energy healing is that consciousness extends beyond the biographical unconscious into an area, for instance, perinatal memory, which is memory in and around the process of birth and of being in the womb. Memories from that area, which are generally not recognized as existing in medical science, emerge during energy healing. And it's not just energy healing, actually. I'm thinking of Dr. Stanislav Grof. He was the first person to talk about this. You may know that he developed holotropic breathwork, and he was a research psychiatrist and one of the pioneers of the transpersonal movement in psychology. And he was astounded when people started to surface perinatal memories of being in the womb and of the birth process and of the traumas often associated with that, simply because it went against everything that he'd been taught in medical school. So there is this kind of emerging awareness that the conventional model of consciousness, and therefore the conventional model of personhood, is far too restrictive. Beyond the perinatal memory, we start to enter memories of past lives. And very often, the ones that emerge in the context of energy healing are memories of traumatic deaths in past lives. Beyond that, we move into the field of familial memory. And we've already just talked about that in the context of family constellation therapy. As to say, it's a modality that surfaces familial memories of a traumatic nature. And indeed, it goes beyond that into ancestral memory. So it's an amazing extension, so to speak, of our concept of personhood, that we have all of these added dimensions of consciousness interacting with us and affecting our health and well-being on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah.
Okay. So only energy healing, really, energy medicine is equipped to begin resolving the traumas in the wider fields of our consciousness.
And I think it's important to point out that this is I mean, it doesn't, it probably shouldn't need stating, but I think it still does need stating that our culture and our way of interacting with health that doesn't involve these concepts of energetic healing is quite rare. It's not common. A lot of cultures throughout the earth have these or have never lost them. And we are the outlier in a sense to have needed to be bringing this back into our consciousness, into our awareness, and into our methodologies of healing. And that's a shame for those of us, you know, born into that and you know, needing to do a little bit of extra work, shall we say, to understand this. But I think it's also a gift that we are kind of at this stage of it coming back into consciousness. And as you mentioned, this does relate to animism and the idea of the, you know, the unfolding of personhood throughout the universe. I just had Gordon White on the show, you know, talking about animistic and, you know, all of these thoughts are kind of bubbling up in a number of different ways. And I think it's beautiful how this is, you know, showing that healing aspect of it and how, you know, that must be a part of our conversations around medical technologies of all kinds.
Yeah. And in fact, you see this even in conventional medical practice. There's a kind of area of overlap now. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you see a lot of hospitals where Reiki practice is admitted, especially in post-operative care. And certainly one of the world's leading heart surgeons, Mehmet Oz, developed the minimally intrusive heart surgery, couples that heart surgery with Reiki. So, you know, okay, the conventional medical world is pretty much frozen in place, okay? But people are just getting on with this stuff themselves because it works. And although there's not, so to speak, the orthodoxy, it doesn't show its face in medical school. Once people start practicing, it's very much there. We had a whole, something like 20 therapists came to us for training in energy psychology. Okay, and what they wanted to know is the practical, you know, how do you do it? How do you actually resolve traumas? So they're in the position of being trained to counsel people, but not to resolve the emergent emotional issues. So a lot of them now, they've started using EMDR, which is kind of has an acceptability about it, and is not normally categorized as an energy healing modality, but what else can it be? You know, has to be. And a lot more.
You just explain what EMDR is just for?
It's the eye movement desensitization process, okay, whereby with an emotional trauma that is present to a person, they can be directed to use eye movements to like relieve that emotional trauma. But this is in a nutshell, basically. And therefore, it operates very much as emotional freedom techniques would do, except with emotional freedom techniques, you're tapping on the meridians. Okay, so these would be ones around the eyes, under the eyes, and here, you know, these are the heads of the major meridians. So whether it's done with eye movement or tapping has the same effect. So we see a lot of therapists now combining therapeutic counseling with EMDR or EFT. So, you know, the crossover has happened in practice for a lot of people. It's just that, you know, the institutional side of it has yet to catch up with this. People are getting on with it, basically.
And probably, I mean, to a degree, always have been. I think there's the misattributed Mark Twain quote about, you know, rumors of my demise have been greatly exaggerated. Yeah. He didn't exactly say that, but it's kind of the same thing where people it's always been predicted as being dead, but then it never actually is with so many occult practices. And then the same thing where there's the myth of no doctors practice this or have any interest in this. They probably always have, but maybe now there is luckily more ability for them to be more open about it and to not feel that openness could be possibly damaging.
I mean, the roots of like homeopathy are in folk medicine, aren't they? You know, it's the two are almost indistinguishable from each other. So one other thing though I need to add there is that we've now moved on a stage, and I'm thinking at the moment about the research work associated with the Dawson Church, who's done a number of studies of emotional freedom techniques used to reduce, greatly ameliorate post-traumatic stress disorder. Okay, so we now have clinical trials showing that EFT can knock down the most severe anxiety disorder known to humanity in the space of a few sessions. And again, it's frustrating. Gary Craig demonstrated this in the early 80s with Vietnam veterans. And here we are, you know, 30, 40 years later, and there's like a plague of PTSD across the world. And yet I don't see any movement because the, so to speak, the organization of things, the hierarchy and the consensus around what can or what can be done is so frozen at that level that people are left to suffer, which is very unfortunate. Again, it's one of the reasons why I felt so impelled to write this book, is to just try and get the message out there. There's so much you can do to empower yourself. You know, I always say to people that, you know, you may want to go along to somebody practicing these techniques for, you know, I know, one or two major issues. But beyond that, you should empower yourself by learning the technique. Mm-hmm. Or get treated as you learn the technique is even better. And then, you know, ultimately, you should be self-managing.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Because then it is that longer process of what being in health kind of is.
Yeah. And you know, this whole issue, of course, is that we want to be in a preventive mode rather than a reactive mode. I mean, you know, we need to deal with stuff before it becomes a major health issue, rather than, you know, waiting for it to manifest on the physical plane. So almost all the emotional traumas have this nature. They tend to be buried in childhood. They're now called adverse childhood experiences, ACEs. And I would say they account for the greater part of the ill health that people suffer, because these childhood experiences also drive all kinds of addictive behavior. That's to say, the kind of, you know, the need to have certain foods which are known to be grossly unhealthy, but which provide a comfort.
Yeah.
So that you're then overlaying the emotional trauma with real health issues, so that you're setting up a kind of negative reinforcing cycle. And the more ill health you experience, the more you want to have those foods which give you a kind of immediate buzz. And the whole process is turned over and driven on by the underlying emotional issues that have never been dealt with and become lost. So, you know, I would urge people to master one or two of these energy healing techniques. Whether they feel they need them or not is not the issue. But in the process of mastering them on themselves, they are going to be able to uncover and release things that are holding them back, themselves back in life. And they're going to be better positioned to help their friends and family around them. So, you know, anybody in the esoteric community at this point, you know, really should be setting out to master one or two of these techniques, especially like, you know, emotional freedom techniques. The training is so accessible online. It's fast, it's easy, and it's one of the most powerful ways in which you can empower yourself to a higher level of energy and effectiveness.
I have many questions that kind of flow on from that, but I figured now is a perfect time, since you just mentioned that. You briefly mentioned EFT earlier, but could you just lay out for people who may not know just the basics of what EFT is and what it, like, what is it? How is it done? Just because I feel like that's something that is, as you mentioned, it's a thing that is quite accessible, and it might be interesting for people to hear.
Okay, so back in the 70s, Roger Callahan developed, I think on the basis of his experience in acupuncture, a set of techniques called thought field therapy. It was generally felt, though, that was a complex system to master. And from it, one of the early people who had attended the thought field therapy training, Gary Craig, simplified it right down to the most fundamental level. And basically what he said, or what he found in practice, was that there are a series of meridians on the front of the body that start around the brows and the eyes. So we can indicate them here, here and at the sides and just under the eyes and on above and beneath the lips. And that when you have a clear and present focus on an emotional upset, by simply tapping on those points, you can immediately release the emotion. So that, and it's permanently, not just pack it away, it's permanently released. So nothing could be simpler, actually. And from there, a whole range of variations on this basic EFT model or pattern have developed worldwide. You know, there's a huge number of people now promoting this or variations of it. One of the things that we quickly found, of course, is that the kinetic element of the tapping is great when you're starting. I mean, it gives you a solid protocol to work with, which is easy to follow. And you don't have to think about it too much. But you quickly find that the tapping itself may not be essential, that you can tap yourself for another person, and that works. And you can imagine tapping yourself, and that seems to work. Okay, and you can tap or imagine tapping for someone who's on the other side of the world, and that can also work. So just from the simple EFT protocol, you get drawn into this far richer, larger world of healing. So it has a kind of double payoff.
Yeah.
I know, but is that okay?
Oh, absolutely. No, it's very, okay. Very helpful. As a first description, I think it's very helpful for people to see that. And it also immediately brings up the strangeness of it, because it's saying, yes, okay, there are these techniques, you have to do these things. Oh, by the way, as you do them, they may also, then the techniques may start to slip away, yet it still works. And we don't understand that quite. But that's not to say that the technique isn't a part of it, but that it's clearly, as in all these things, a lot broader and weirder than it even appears on the surface.
Yeah,
really, it's important point.
So it's that participation in the larger field of consciousness that very much comes to the fore as you start working with energy healing. Mm-hmm. And that sense of participation is an immensely enriching experience, because it tends to fold time and space. So that folding of time and space is a major insight into, in a sense, our existential position. Time and space are kind of illusory. They are the constructs by which we manage our interaction with reality, but they're not reality itself. Time is not actually a feature of the physical world, okay? So we are ourselves unbounded in a way which exceeds our day-to-day experience. Okay, and as we begin to enter this unbounded reality, we begin to get a better measure of the empowerment that we each have as individuals to command and to change reality, to reshape it. But it's kind of conditional upon our willingness to embrace past pain, discomfort, and upset and let go of them, because they are the real anchors to the full measure of our personhood.
Yeah, and the stepping into that, because it is more than just us discussing this and someone reading the book is really lovely and helpful, but at the same time, then there is a point where you have to step in and move into the actual practice of it. Even if eventually the tapping is not something that you have to physically do, there is a physicality to learning it, to actually, you know, taking action in an embodied way.
Yeah.
Do this work.
it's an important stepping point, you know, to to begin to engage physically with the processes and then to explore beyond them. So one thing I'd like to say in this context, though, is the position of these kind of healing arts in the context of the esoteric community or the occult community. And one of the things that really struck me is I was working on a diagram of kind of shamanic practices. Okay. And when I looked at that, you know, I took a kind of generic view of shamanic practice around the world and said, well, okay, what are shaman actually doing? And I kind of laid it out in a number of dimensions. And when I looked at it closely, 80, 90% of what they're doing is healing work. You know, so in a sense, the modern esoteric and occult community has slipped away from that community awareness, family awareness, you know, and the core importance of healing as a practice, as opposed to any of the other practices that we undertake.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I was grinning because I was going to be going in that direction immediately after. So that is okay.
Preempted you, John.
Preempted.
So where this also touches on esotericism and the other world is like this practice of like ghost hunting, which is a kind of, I don't know, the way that we frame death and the afterlife is important. So as energy healers, you often come across cases in which people have died and not realized that they're dead. And there are a number of cases in the book about this. Some deceased persons appear within an energy healing session because that is an energetic space between the healer and the client. That forms an energetic space. And just as in family constellation therapy, that field gives access to a larger field, which may include people who've passed on and who either have not realized they're dead or have unresolved issues. They need things to be said or done which they feel are missing or they failed to do in their lifetime. And this shows that the energy healing is also required for the deceased. Okay, so that, you know, this thing about like ghost hunting overlooks the fact that you're dealing with a personhood on a different order than yourself, which may well be kind of lost in having died unexpectedly and in need of help. So this is another dimension that energy healing highlights, and it's not often talked about. But I want to put it there because I know within the esoteric and occult community, there's a lot of interest in the deceased or the transition. But I'm saying that that is also a healing opportunity. And especially the transition from life to death is incredibly important when you consider the number of deep traumas associated with traumatic death in a previous life. So how we come face to face with death and how we handle it is incredibly important and part of the healer's journey.
Absolutely. And that conversation around death is one that, as you've said, has not, we still continue, even when we're trying to talk about it in a different way, sometimes the way that our language slips into it can unfortunately undermine the conversation, like using the word hunting, like ghost hunting, instead of,
yeah,
you know, like a relationship, like a discovery. I mean, we're this kind of a product of pop culture, scary movies, things of that nature are going to make it, you know, more dramatic. Not that it isn't intense or dramatic, but that it unfortunately biases the conversation towards something that is not predicated on service, on healing, on, you know,
exactly,
better relationship.
Yeah. It's the empathic response to situations that is largely missing in modernity, isn't it? You know.
Yeah, yeah,
and you know, we're all
world, yeah.
So another dimension of that, of course, is the other than human. Mm-hmm. Again, this is something that is there in energy healing? There are a number of cases, I think, in the book, and there's some of them which I didn't want to put in the book, but I put in my academia.edu page. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's a case of possession. Okay. And I'd say to anyone getting into energy healing is to be wary of attempting to deal with cases in which possession is involved. You know, it, you see, part of the danger is that we slip into these situations and our sense of the personhood of the other than human is not well defined. Okay, so we don't know what we're dealing with, and we tend to underplay or underestimate, even more dangerous, what it is that we're seeking to deal with. Okay, so in an energy healing community, you need to have an escalation procedure. You need to know, you need to have a, you know, you need to have your senses awake, and you need to know that if you come across cases of possession-like behavior. And, you know, there's like four steps in possession, isn't there? You know, there's like infestation, which is when people wake up with bruises, cuts, or whatever, you know, that they can't account for. There's a series of unaccountable accidents in and around them in the home. And from there, it kind of can escalate towards more oppressive behavior, and then it becomes obsessive. That's to say, the person buys into this energy and starts to become attracted to it. It often has a sexual element. Okay. And beyond that is full involuntary possession. And that's what we're talking about here. We're not talking about voluntary possession, which is thergy. We're talking about the involuntary. And it's often predicated on early childhood trauma. Okay, so you start off with a case of early childhood trauma, and you can find yourself in a much deeper water. It's very rare, but it happens. So knowing this escalation ladder, you should be able to say at what point you need to get off that and refer. There are people who can deal with possession, but they're very few and far between. And, you know, you can become the target if you're not careful. And even if you're successful, you know, it kind of eats part of your soul. So anyway, that is there. Let's put it on the table. It is there. It's rare. There is a case on academia.edu if people want to refer to it. But it's certainly out of the ordinary. I mean, I can think of maybe two cases in the 20 odd years.
Yeah, of course. And but I think it's important. It's an important part of the conversation, because it also it brings up the idea that we kind of tend to want to flip between two extremes, which is that if there are non-ordinary persons, like if we are interacting with spirits in any way, shape, or form, whether that's, you know, your grand, like a dead person or a land spirit or anything of that nature, it's either idealized and turned into something that is completely good and can do no harm and can do no wrong, or the exact opposite. And it is pure evil. Every spirit of that type is probably going to hurt you or possess you or do something terrible in your life. And we don't have, like, that's clearly because we've lost the thread of how to interact in a healthy way, in a respectful way. Where
there's a kind of lack of nuance, isn't there?
Yeah, a great,
you know, from an energy healing perspective, what I see is that the other than human elements that are extremely negative from our perspective are generally parasitic. Okay, so they're looking to lock onto a source of energy. And in doing so, they may also achieve a degree of spiritual evolution. But that said, most of us are not equipped to carry that kind of attachment. We got enough issues going on like, without that. So I'm not recommending it. But we also need to recognize that, you know, in our empathic engagement with this animistic universe, there are energy forms that are attracted to us, you know, like a moth to a light. Okay. And very often it's not hostile intent so much as the intense need to engage and merge with an energy field. Okay. So the kind of classic exorcist style demonic force is, you know, I'm not sure if that exists actually. The closest I've kind of had knowledge of is a kind of jinn. Mm-hmm. You know, but then, you know, it's only when you go around poking your stick into their hole.
Yeah, yeah.
You're going to get bitten, you know?
Absolutely, which but is yet another
they're
reason.
They're not really concerned with us because they're living essentially parallel, but not interacting with our world. You know, so you need to make incredible effort to actually interact with them. You know, there's no reason why they should tolerate that, actually.
This is the other reason why whole systems and traditions have ways in which these things are trained. It's not just to, yeah. It's not, what's the word these days? Gatekeep. It's not just to gatekeep. It's also that it's like, well, we sometimes it's good to learn the safer ways to do something so that you don't unintentionally.
Yeah.
Do something that could be harmful to you. And you don't want to get paranoid about that because that's not helpful to like operate from, you know, a place of fear, yeah. But it's also, you know, a healthy respect for the personhood means that you need to be respectful and aware that you may not Absolutely. Know everything about a situation. You may not know what the intentions good or not so great for you of various things you're interacting with. And our culture doesn't make a lot of space for that. So that's.
Yeah. Again, it's this failure of empathy. I think, you know, this knowing that there is an other than human there, but not treating them as a personhood worthy of respect. You know, that is a formula for trouble.
Yes, absolutely. So I think then that kind of goes into, because we've been talking about forms of knowledge. I mean, what is the name of this podcast, but Coffee and Divination. And yeah. A lot of what we've been talking about is coming to understand what's at the root of something. So the very first example you gave us of family constellation therapy, I mean, that kind of overlay of information on people who are essentially strangers, oftentimes I'm assuming not trained in any way. You could just be a person who's told to stand there. And now you're my mother. You've never met me before. And then there's some sort of information that you get just by virtue of standing there in essentially ritual space.
Yes.
That is a form of knowledge that is coming to a person. That is, I think in the book you talk about transformational versus transpersonal altered states. So that's a transpersonal bit of information coming through in order to do work with it. So there is a divinatory aspect. If we, you know, there's a larger field of knowledge that in doing healing work, you're tapping into. So that is.
Absolutely.
Are there ways that you, I mean, because like I said, with that, that's a form of divination. That's a form of larger information that you're getting.
Yes.
Are there other examples like that outside of like simply possessive trance where like you are going in, dropping down into a trance and getting information about what is bothering someone? Like what is at the root of this, which is essentially then shamanism. Are there other examples of how you would see that information coming through that you want to talk about?
Well, the one I very briefly mentioned is at the very core of healing. That's you and a client. Mm-hmm. And immediately you engage with that client. There's a field generated, interpersonal, transpersonal field. The only question is whether your awareness is open enough to allow the information to be transferred. So, in the book, I mean, clearly my partner, Kenzie, a lot of her examples and cases are in there, okay? And what I can say is that when she's working one-on-one, there's often a nexus of trauma, which the client is no longer aware of, okay? It's buried in childhood, or they're not ready to acknowledge it for whatever reason. So what will happen is that she will become aware of an image or a word, which lies at the very root of the trauma. Okay. The feel, in other words, her healing intent, her empathy and engagement with the client is sufficient to navigate the client's field of consciousness. And it produces exactly the image, a symbolic image, the word necessary to trigger the healing in the client. So it's a kind of teleological navigation of the wider field of consciousness. Let's say it's end directed through empathic intent and retrieves from the field exactly the information necessary for that person in that time and space to begin a process of healing. So, we can see this mini model as kind of applicable on any level of generality you wish. So part of the healing skill is the development of these qualities of deep listening. Okay, the empathic engagement and the allowing the information to come, and when it comes, to act on it.
Absolutely. And it is that real need that then is causing that field to form between the person and the healer so that information can come through. It is not just a fact-finding mission just out of curiosity or something. It is because that is the information that is needed, and therefore that's what comes through.
Yeah, it's intent-driven and empathic, yeah.
Yeah, I think that goes back to what you were talking about healing being very central as a focus for so much, really the deepest roots of magical practice, because, these things they're not hobbies that you're just doing for fun. They are for very serious intent to help yourself while also helping others. And I think that's also, I practice like Gordon does, Lynn McTaggart, intention work. And it's amazing to look at the figures in terms of I've had it happen to me. It just like the wonderful impacts, the positive impacts that come to the healer, to the person who is intending for someone else. And so there's that relationality that's really important. It's not about me going and doing it just because I want to help myself, but because that's how this stuff works, is in the interaction between us helping each other, the healer sort of being healed through the act of helping another. Would you?
Absolutely. I mean, for me, the personhood is too narrow a platform upon which to place significance or meaning in life. Mm-hmm. Okay, the personhood is not sufficient to generate significance and meaning in life. It's only when we step beyond our personhood to service. So this larger movement from I to we is the movement which characterizes leadership, and it's the movement that characterizes a service orientation. And when we do that, we heal ourselves in a very profound way, because we generate meaning. Meaning is not there to be discovered. You can't go and search for meaning. If you do not generate it from your heart, it's not going to exist. And the way to generate it is by recognizing an element of service in life as an integral part of breathing, drinking and eating. Okay, it's that fundamental.
Absolutely. I think that is, I certainly as a musician try to keep that in mind, that is the whole point of doing music is because it is service. It is service to the art, and it's service to those that listen. And the same could be said with divination, where it's not you can do it for fun as a parlor trick, because sometimes fun is enough. But it is at its heart, it is also service, because it is that interaction and relationality of you and the art, and you and whoever it is that you're getting information for, which has a purpose.
It's the immediate transcendence, isn't it, of the smaller self.
Yeah.
Whatever problems and troubles that smaller self has dealing with life, in the act of serving, they're transcended. It's a relativization of the ego-centered awareness, so that it now occupies its correct place rather than dominates the space.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's profoundly healing in and of itself.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm. I think this also kind of, there's another relationship between healing and something that comes up, at least in divination, which is the idea of, I usually ask guests whenever we're talking about divination, what is their opinion about, you know, when they get a bad fate, when something comes out on the table that somebody doesn't like, or when you're told something by your guides that you don't particularly like to hear. And I think that that ties into the idea of addressing the nature of illness and unwellness, because there is our culture. I think we come back to that, like, you know, Protestant ideal of like, you should just be perfect and happy all the time. And if you're not, there's probably something wrong with you and it's probably your fault. And there's sort of a need to heal how people even think about being unwell so that we can sort of allow space for that without either victim blaming ourselves and sort of understand what it is to be unwell in a different way. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how do you view illness. We've talked a little bit about like childhood trauma and how it comes back from other roots. So that's, I'm sure, a part of it. But is there something about that that you want to talk about?
I think there's like two levels, isn't there? There's the level of the healer who needs to engage with these things. Okay. And needs to find solutions in effect. And there's a metaphysical level in as much as we need to acknowledge this human frailty terminates with death. Okay. But death is not the end of it. Okay. So the place of illness and death itself needs to be encompassed in a much larger field of understanding. And it's essentially, it's that that's missing and which makes illness and terminal illness seem so frightening. Okay. So what energy healing has helped me with is to recontextualize the processes of entropy, essentially. And, you know, I don't know if people know it, but Erwin Schrödinger, you know, one of the founders of quantum mechanics, wrote a book. Actually, it's no more than an essay, but it's What is Life? And he says it's the play of entropy and syntropy. Let's say negative entropy. Okay, so I think there's another dimension to this that we haven't discussed, and that's the forms of healing which interact with higher order beings, and specifically with healing beings. So anyone who has Usui Reiki as a discipline or a practice is working with a set of higher order healing beings, okay? And that also recontextualizes the whole process of life, because we're now part of a much vaster continuum. The Reiki energy is not my energy. I simply channel it, okay? But it is sufficient to affect the most marvelous healing. Okay, all of a sudden, I'm now part of a team. The major part of it is totally invisible to me and to anyone else. Mm-hmm. And I sent you a photograph, you may recall, showing the Reiki energy. That's one of a sequence of four photographs. And what had happened is that at the end of the Reiki training, I had taken a photograph of the group standing, you know, in front of a bookcase. And I had, this was around 2002, I think. I had one of the first of the little digital cameras, really simple plastic thing, you know, no processing on it. It just like took an image and stored it on a little disc. And I took the photograph using a flash because it was indoors. And it was like I had stood in front of a mirror and taken a photograph with the flash straight into a mirror. And the light just came straight back into my eyes. And I thought, oh dear, what's wrong? Let's try that again, you know? So I took another photograph. And again, the light just came flash blinding into the viewfinder, you know? So I did a third and a fourth one. Finally, there was no flash. Even though I was using the flash, it didn't flash back at me. It was only when we uploaded the images that I realized that the flash had hit a field And that my partner, Kenzie, at that point was invoking the Reiki energy. She was drawing one of the so-called Reiki symbols. And that the energy had chosen that point or that time to manifest itself in sufficient density that it acted as a reflective surface. And so over the course of the four photographs, you see the first one is kind of orange all over. And there's like structural form within that orange field. And some of the people have distinct auras. And and then over the course of the four photographs, it like fades out. The fourth one is just a normal photograph. So I don't think there's anything like this. I've never seen anything like this in my life. And, but I understood that the energy had decided, the beings or entities behind the Reiki energy had decided to manifest themselves in a form where they would interact with physical light in order to produce these images. So I'm going to send you those images, the four of them.
Absolutely.
And, you know, we can put them out there. So when I say we're part of a much larger team, 90% of which or more is totally invisible to us. This is another aspect or dynamic of the energy healer's work. Okay.
Yeah.
We normally think of it in terms of shaman working with ancestral spirits and so on and so forth, but actually it's integral to the healing process itself. And, you know, those other forms may be familial or ancestral thought forms or persons who manifest in the healing space for a reason, or they may be the other than human higher order beings.
Absolutely. And that kind of coming to that awareness then is the process of finally recognizing that we are within a much larger community of beings helps both the healer and the person who's being healed to accept that and understand where they are. And like you said, that doesn't mean that every problem has an instantaneous solution or that any of us, you know, cheat death. That's not the purpose. And that's not actually true healing to begin with, because that's a misunderstanding of how incarnation is supposed to work and how we're supposed to relate to being here and then being elsewhere in another.
I mean, healing is also making the transition in death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or assisting somebody in that transition.
Yeah.
You know, that is also healing work. And a great opportunity for Reiki to ease that process.
Absolutely.
I
want to just, there's one question that I wanted to ask, because I always find it interesting. What is a misunderstanding of alternative healing modalities? Because whenever I'm talking to people about witchcraft, or, you know, my co-high priestess and I are talking about our coven and things like that, it's always interesting for us to discuss what we think misunderstandings might be about what we do. And then when we get questions from people, sometimes those misunderstandings are not what we expect. And I was wondering if there's a thing that you think you'd want to address for people if they come to it and you see this as a thing people don't understand a lot of times.
Well, I think the most obvious one is people think that people do energy healing instead of going to the doctor, and thereby miss out, a proper diagnosis and treatment. Mm-hmm. But that's not the case. You know, certainly in our experience, the people coming for energy healing have been to several doctors, several therapists, psychiatrists. They've been on and off various drugs and prescriptions, and have finally lost patience with that process. They're looking for something deeper. So it's not like people skip medicine or skip psychotherapy for energy healing. It's not the case. And certainly anyone coming to us who is under, for instance, psychiatric supervision, we don't deal with, because almost invariably, if they have psychiatric supervision, they are probably taking very powerful drugs. And as energy healers, we're simply not equipped to deal with that. Okay. People under psychiatric supervision may need emergency care, for instance. And as an energy healer, you're not equipped with anything to deal with that. So we operate within a fairly circumscribed band. We never diagnose or prescribe. And that's one of the advantages of the energy healing techniques, that you don't need to do that. We're very much focused on healthy eating, exercise, and using the energy healing techniques for emotional traumas and upsets, which are long-lived. Okay, so having a clear scope about what we do and what we don't do is important, because people tend to think that you're just barging in and trying to do the doctor's or the psychiatrist's job for them, and it's not the case. That's not our business at all. Okay. And if people are really interested in getting energy healing and they have this kind of supervision, then we direct them to find a therapist or psychiatrist who also works with the energy healing techniques. Okay.
So it's a supportive team then that you're working with.
Yeah. So, you know, it's this integrative is a far better word than alternative. It is an alternative to anything. It's integrative medicine that we're interested in. And beyond integrative medicine, energy healing. So it's like a spectrum. So it becomes integrative medicine when you have appropriate medical support. Even if it's acupuncture, that's still a medical profession, okay? But it's like a spectrum there, because we're all dealing with the energy body and the energy field, okay?
I recently had Ivy Bromius on, talking about how she wrote the cancer grimoire and her cancer journey. And that was really an inspiring conversation, and inspiring, you know, what she came through with, you know, through that experience. And I think it's also good to once again say, you know, because there are now starting to be medical doctors that are more open to this. They're out there. They exist. You know, she found them. They are there. So, you know, finding people, even if you need to work with people that are, you know, in that allopathic context, which is sometimes very, very important, there are supportive ways to do that. And I think that's absolutely important.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, most of the good hospitals now kind of accommodate this. They do their best to, you know, especially in post-care environments, they're normally very happy to have Reiki on board with that process.
Wonderful. That is wonderful to hear.
Yeah.
About time, I would say, but you know. So you've mentioned that you are allowing, and this is very similar to like in spell work, or at least a lot of times the way that we do spell work in our tradition, like the idea of the energy flowing through you. You are not doing it.
Yeah.
You are allowing it to be done through you, and you are sort of part of the vessel or the tool or the channel, whatever you want to call it. I think that's really lovely. Is there anything specific to that for you? Like if you're, I mean, this probably then goes into too much of the specifics of Reiki, which is out. I'm sure it's too big a conversation for this, but are there any particular practices that you do in your own work to help you prepare to sort of like be in a good space to be that channel? Are there, like, is it a practice of like prayers to, you know, particular spirits or particular meditative practices that you do, or what are some of the supportive things that you do for yourself?
Well, the self-care with Reiki is critically important. And that means I dedicate time in the morning and every night without fail to practice Reiki on myself. And any time during the day when my hands are not engaged, I will apply Reiki to myself, so that I'm kind of in the field continuously. I'm never out of it. Mm-hmm. Well, that's one discipline. The other one is we bought this angulation bed. I don't know if they have them in the US. These are German beds you can lie on. And okay, let me explain this a bit better.
I've heard this before, so you won't have to explain.
Sorry?
I've never heard of it before, so I'm glad you're going to explain it.
Okay. So there was a recognition at some point, probably in the 70s, I'm not sure when, that a certain frequency range a measurable frequency range is a healing frequency, okay? And this is a field that shifts or undulates between 0.5 and roughly 80 hertz or cycles per second, electromagnetic wave, okay? Between those two frequency ranges address every component of the human body. That's the bones, the skin, the viscera, the organs, everything is covered. So that if you set up a standing wave, an artificially induced one, mechanical one, in other words, in a device, that will tend to promote healing. So they discovered that elderly people who, say, broke a leg and the healing takes so long, they could wrap a blanket in which the wires were inbuilt around the leg or the arm or whatever, and then pass this alternating current through it, through sweeping through these frequencies, then the healing would tend to happen far faster. And we now know that the same frequency range, 0.5 to 80, 90 hertz, is the frequency range generated by the hands of healers. Okay, except in the case of Reiki, the amplitude of those waves can be up to 1,000 times higher than in a normal person. Okay, so given this like core of science, you can now construct a bed in which there's 20 or 30 electromagnets embedded within it, and a series of programs that get them running through this frequency, sweeping through these frequencies as you lie on it. Okay. And
fascinating.
Yeah. So the Andulation is a German brand. It was originally developed for sports teams like gymnasts and people who had a lot of heavy wear on their joints and so on to speed the recovery process. So we invested in one of these beds, and I'm using that every 2 or 3 days, and it's almost an immediate energy gain.
That is fascinating. Okay. I will have to definitely look into that and possibly put something in the show notes about that.
Yeah, and you know, like if you have a community, you could invest in having one. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it comes with a whole series of programs for a whole variety of conditions. So, you know, originally we'd invested in this when we had an office. But with the pandemic, we had to close the office, of course, you know, because it was forbidden to be out and about. Mm-hmm. So we ended up with this Andulation embedded home.
Well, for you, of course.
It's wonderful. Yeah. So I have that as a backup. One of the good things about that is that doing Reiki is of course time intensive. You need to set like 20 minutes, 30 minutes aside to do it. And I do it especially for my eyes, because as a professional author, my eyes take a hammering. So I recover my eyes. I don't know whether you have any joint issues as a musician. Of course, Reiki is ideal for that. But then there's the overall energy. You can't always give yourself a full energy healing with Reiki, because, you know, unless there's a functioning group, we used to do like 2 nights a week, like from 7 till midnight, whoever came would get treated, and everyone who came would be treated. You know, at times we were running 2 or 3 Reiki beds in parallel. So unfortunately, all that is gone. You know, it's the pandemic has wiped away that kind of communal work. So the Andulation bed substitutes for a full body treatment. Yep. So it's almost, you know, instant revival. You know, like a 15-minute session. And you can change the sessions for, like, you know, circulation, muscle recovery, back pain, whatever, you know, it's programmed. So, yeah, that's been an important part of maintaining a good energy, mm-hmm. The Reiki practice, and the fact that, you know, as a professional author, I'm working on things which I deeply and profoundly believe in. and love to do. And that is incredibly important, because I say it's that shift from I to we, which is the essence of leadership, does so much to help cope with the anxieties of our age, let's say, which are manifold and increasing exponentially as we speak.
And which makes all of these practices that much more imperative.
Yeah, absolutely. People need to realize that, you know, the kind of world in which you could have a career and a house and live in essentially a peaceful environment is a shrinking one. You know, careers and so on are far more ad hoc now. Your opportunity to own a property and live in it is getting more and more difficult across the world. And the anxieties around the uncertainty of life is increasing. So that all is a battering on your immune system, you know, on top of that, unhealthy food, of course. So, yeah, cortisol levels are higher than they should be. And that tends to reduce our immunity and makes us vulnerable. So whatever we can do to counteract, you know, those forces, those societal forces, and energy healing is probably that one of the best, you know, steps we can all take. Absolutely. To begin to reverse and, you know, push those things back a little.
And I think that reading a book like yours also helps a great deal, because it helps to counter some of those narratives of fear that we're being sort of fed a lot these days. Not that they're not important, you know, to listen and know what's going on, but that we also need to be feeding ourselves with a lot more of those things that are possible, so that we can put our time and attention on helping ourselves and then helping those around us, which I think is a beautiful thing to put that impetus back on service, and then knowing that through that you're actually getting more health and more happiness. Yeah. And so many benefits from that through the act of service, both to yourself and others.
Well, I was delighted the other day to learn that the esoteric publisher in Ukraine, Inverted Tree, you know, they have the rights to The Power of the Healing Field, and they're currently working on its translation now into Ukrainian. So, you know, it was wonderful. They said to me, we're very hopeful that this book, when we can get it out, will be helpful in people, helping people recover from the trauma of the war, of course. I hope the publisher seems to be moving around the country a lot. So I hope they can finally find a peaceful enough area to settle and try and get the book out. And anyway, I was delighted to hear that, you know, that work, people are going on doing their best, even under the worst of circumstances.
Absolutely. That is wonderful. I really hope that comes to be very quickly for everyone. As we wrap up, is there any, I love to leave space, if there's any last thing that you want to leave people with, a piece of advice or something that you think would be good to focus on? You've already shared so much at this point, but is there anything you feel like you want to touch on before we kind of wrap up?
I think this question of the presence of higher order beings in the life stream, in the human life stream, and around the human life stream is an important one, and it's very difficult to get a handle on it. I think my sense of them is that their vibrational level is kind of beyond us. So that, you know, it's only through, I think, what the esoteric community would call an egregore, that we have an opportunity to, so to speak, interface with them. But it's incredibly important that we recognize the continuity of higher orders of consciousness and being as part of reality. You know, we're kind of directed downwards a lot to look at, you know, stuff which is threatening, stuff which is unpleasant, which we don't want to deal with. And we can lose perspective, I think, on the bigger picture. Yeah. So, you know, I would, and I hope I've done this in the book, is to try and, at the end of it, reposition our personhood in a larger frame. Okay, that's the best I can put it. That larger frame exists, and it's when we become part of an evolutionary spirit in our day-to-day activity that we kind of can connect with that larger frame of meaning and purpose and a higher spiritual growth that we all aspire to. Okay, that is part of reality as well, but it's up to us to step forward in our own small ways and engage with that. And I think at the point at which you engage with it, you know those beings are in alignment with you. You kind of sense that. Whatever your pantheon is, you will have that sense of support in the way as you go forward, as you help, as you express your talents in the service of a wider community, then know that you're accompanied on that way. You know, you're aligned with an evolutionary force working through history and through human civilization, essentially, which I see it as a kind of peak of. So for me, it points to a higher personhood to which we aspire, and which in a evolutionary time period we're probably going to realize. Okay, so this order of being that we find ourselves within is not the end all and be all. That through the gateway of death, there's an entrance to higher orders of being and better ways of being and better worlds. But it's up to us to take those steps and begin to align ourselves with the spiritual forces of growth and evolution and spiritual awareness. I think that I was trying to get that into the book. I'm not sure if I succeeded, but
no, I think you absolutely did beautifully. Yeah, in the final segments, and I think that is that's a wonderful and deeply joyful and empowering, you know, way of expressing that. Which it's right now. You can start right now. There is no need start from anywhere but where you are right now, which I think is a beautiful way of putting it.
So essentially the energy healing techniques then come into play when you find that negative thought coming up saying, no, it's not for you, or you can't get there. Mm-hmm. That's where the techniques come in. You start eliminating those. I mean, in most people's lives, there's probably two or three things, emotional disturbances, which hold them back. Okay. They are like the really tall trees in the forest. And you take the technique and you chop those down. And after you've done that, you open the road. Okay. But it's incumbent upon all of us to take that first step to doing that. Master one or two techniques. And I could talk a little bit about the techniques because they do exist on a spectrum of intensity. Mm-hmm. And that's not often discussed. And what I want to say there is like EFT exists on a fairly low level of intensity. Rebirthing breathwork exists on a very high level of intensity. Okay. And high levels of intensity are not for everyone. So, you know, we need to recognize that and choose techniques that accord with our own nature. Again, some people are very much in tune with their feelings and able to connect with them, and other people are not. So that, for instance, the breathwork techniques do not require you to verbalize an issue. You simply use the breathing technique to raise your inner energy. Your inner energy surfaces the problems, and they're resolved through the breathing process. So it's all done non-cognitively, so to speak. It's not a discussion. Some of the other techniques require a very direct and clear focus on the emotional disturbance. So you need to have people who are articulate about what they're feeling. And you don't need to go intensely into the feeling, into the emotional disturbance, but you need to have a good connection with it. And then, for instance, using mind connection healing, emotional freedom techniques, you can release that. Okay. When you first start out, if there's these couple of really tall trees in the emotional forest, right, which are problematic, it's good to get facilitation with that. And then to learn the process yourself at the same time. Because when those really big trees are gone, everything else is going to be real easy for you. And invariably, we find that when people chop down those couple of really big trees in their emotional forest, everything changes in their lives. All their relationships reset. Relationships with money, relationships with power, relationships with family, workmates, work itself. So that when you, so to speak, remove certain emotional blockages, you reconstellate the entirety of your experience of reality. And it's important people realize that, because that's the huge gain from a very simple process of emotional cleansing. Okay. You step into a new reality for yourself. One that you know, it's kind of like a shock. Again and again, we have clients coming back to us and saying, you know, like, everything just changed. You know, whether that's finding a partner, finding a better job, finding better relationships within the family or within the workspace, it reconstellates reality around you when you clear the emotional issues. And that is within the grasp of everybody, because the techniques are there.
And people need to know about them and need to be aware that those possibilities are there for them, which is why it's beautiful that you wrote that book. And it has so many beautiful examples of, you know, different people whose experiences were touched by those techniques. And as you said, there are different circumstances and different techniques that might work better for, you know, one person or one issue than another, which is why kind of exploring these is so important. But thank you for kind of breaking that down, because that does, I think that will help people when they're thinking about these things and thinking about who they might go to and what they might want to learn.
Yeah. Wonderful. And I tend to try and recommend techniques which you can learn yourself, you know. Mm-hmm. So, you know, some of the energy healing techniques like family constellation therapy, you need a proper training for that, you know, but you can attend it as a participant observer. You know, it's incredibly educational. Or you can go along wanting therapy if you have that sense that there's something in the ancestral or familial field that is disturbing, you know. Other techniques are, you know, 9 times out of 10, you should learn the technique yourself. You know, you should go to someone who can teach you the technique and facilitate the first few sessions, okay? Now, you want to come away with something in your hands that you can then apply to your life on an ongoing basis. That's so important.
Yeah, because it is not a passive thing. It is a very active thing. Well, that is wonderful. And I'm sure we could talk for a lot longer about all of this.
Yeah.
It's so fascinating.
I'm sure.
Literally, you know, thousands of years of history and healing techniques. So for people, where should people look for you and where should they find you? I will, of course, have links, but are there things that you want to let people know that are coming up from you or that, you know, you want to share?
Mindconnectionhealing.com is the site. Kenzie is there. Mm-hmm. In fact, we're running a class. It's set for people on the West Coast of the US this coming weekend. You know, if people want to learn a technique and deal with some of their emotional issues with Kenzie, Saturday, Sunday, 7th and 8th of May, you know, just get onto Mind Connection Healing, drop her a line, 2 or 3 lines saying, you know, what it is you want to do. And that's an opportunity. She is an extraordinary healer. And I think that's evident from the cases in the book. Mindconnectionhealing.com. For myself, I'm just a mere scribe. And you can find me at petermarkadams.com or all over the internet.
Various locations of your work.
Yes,
that is wonderful.
Be a scribe.
I don't know about that. We can go with that for now, I guess, but I don't think anyone believes that. So, well, thank you very much, Peter. It has been wonderful. I can't wait until the next time.
Yeah, me too. It's always a pleasure. Thank you so much, Joanne.
Stars overhead, don't you dare.